Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 423 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 22nd of March, 2019, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Damon Swade about Verbalize, strengthen your writing with the power of words. Damon is a real live wire. He's super entertaining and also informative and will get you thinking about words and even about your own life. And I also have an extended introduction since I missed last week. So let's dive in. In publishing news, here are my thoughts on London Book Fair. Now, I went for 2 days and as ever, I was completely broken by it. I don't know whether I'm actually getting worse in terms of the sort of social anxiety slash introvert self. I'm finding it just more and more hard. And maybe it's because I've pulled away so much. I just find it much harder to do these big events. But yeah, the book fairs are so worthwhile, but they are super tiring. So you definitely have to schedule recovery time afterwards. So the big focus of London Book Fair this year was audio. So lots and lots of audio seminars. There was a quantum conference for publishers on the Monday before the fair, and that was a lot about audio as well. So here's, I went to quite a few seminars, and here's just a few of the things that I found interesting. So first of all, they said 54% of listeners to audiobooks are aged 18 to 44, which is actually amazing because it's a very difficult group to reach with books and incredibly positive for longer term sales. So essentially, I'm sure you know with your readers or even how old you are, a lot of readership is generally older. And so, you know, you'll know if you run author events, a lot of people who come will be older than that, older than the 18 to 44 group. And also someone said to me that they realized that people walking along the street with headphones are not necessarily listening to music. They could also be listening to podcasts or audiobooks. And in fact, if you see me with headphones in, I am listening to an audiobook or a podcast. So that demographic is fascinating. They also said 83% of audiobook listeners had also read a book in the last year, so had also bought ebook or print. Podcast listeners listen to twice as many books as non-podcast listeners. So podcasting is a great way to market audio. And this is a tip I've been talking about for a while, which is if you have a book in a niche, then pitch podcasters in that niche for, you know, to try and get on their show. And of course, if you do pitch, you must always say how you can help their audience, because it's not about you, it's about the audience of the show. 30% of audiobook sales are non-correlated with ebook sales, which is fascinating. So it's a different market. So people might be buying an audiobook and not the ebook, whereas I presume from the stat they had assumed that most, well, I guess most are correlated. And certainly with Audible, if you own the ebook, then the audiobook is cheaper. Another thing is they said audiobooks don't really have a piracy problem like ebooks and even print books do. So, of course, you know, some of the biggest issues with things like the latest Harry Potter book, you know, it was out on the pirate sites before the print books were opened in the stores. So audiobooks don't have that type of piracy problem. I think because it's harder to, that there's a lot more to download if you download audio files, and then you have to listen to them on something. So there's definitely a lot more barrier to entry in terms of piracy, which is a good thing. Also, lots of talk about what we would call wide, they called fragmentation of the audio industry. So on the stage, the big publishers had a huge stress on being wide with audio and said, look, it used to be Audible, but now it is they're focusing on a lot more in terms of global rights and other stores. So they mentioned Storytel, Scribd, HiBooks, and also other non-exclusive subscription models, also libraries. And I'm certainly loving the library checkout model, which you can get to through Findaway Voices. Libraries, instead of having to pay outright for your book, they can actually just pay per checkout. So it's cheaper per checkout, but as the author overall, you're going to get money for the long term instead of just one payment. So I love that. Which reminds me, I am not anti-subscription model at all. I am anti-exclusivity, especially when it comes to books being available to libraries. And this really was brought home to me at London Book Fair because a lot of people talk to me about Wide, and it was very clear that people don't understand what it means, especially, for example, you can be Wide with print and audiobook even if you don't want to be Wide with your ebook. So say you're in KDP Select, you can also be Wide with print and audiobooks. And also a lot of indies who are in Select didn't really realise that libraries can't use their books. Anything that is locked within the Amazon ecosystem is not in a library. And I know that many authors love libraries. And yeah, I mean, most of us grew up in libraries. I certainly did. So I love the fact that all my books, ebook, print, and audiobook, can be in libraries. Also, a lot of people talking to me, like people who came into indie 2015, 2016, and later, think that there's only one model, one successful model, which is KDP Select plus paid ads plus rapid release. Of course, that is only one of the many options available to indies. So because I literally had every single question at the fair was about this topic, I'm going to do another show on Wide distribution and a solo show, which means I have to prepare it. So that will come up in a few weeks' time. So back on audio, a lot of talk about audio growth linked to screen fatigue and the fact that people want to read, but also while doing other things and also while not looking at a screen. And actually, when I was recovering from the book fair, one of the things I did was lie with my eyes closed listening to an audiobook. And in fact, you can often find me and my husband at the weekend, both of us lying there on the bed or the sofa listening to stories. And it's a bit like being a kid again, you know, you're relaxed. With a story being told to you. Also, audiobook at launch, a lot of the talk was saying audio is just another format now. It's like when readers will get annoyed if you release the ebook separately to the print book, as well as if you release the audio separately. So if you're going to do effective marketing of audio, then have audio available at launch. This is probably the biggest challenge for indie authors. Most of us, I mean, I've only been doing print at the same time, probably for the last 2 years. Before that, I would always do ebook first, print a few, you know, maybe a few weeks later to make sure I'd picked up all the typos. And then I've done audio generally a lot later. But this is interesting because audio at launch means we have to hold back our books. And that's something that if you are doing that rapid release model, or even if you're someone like me who just likes to finish a book and get it out there, then this is a challenge. So I found that very interesting. Also interesting was listening to big publisher Wiley. Wiley are a non-fiction publisher. They said they were looking at the last 80 years of production and publishing and intellectual property and starting to do audiobooks for their backlist. And when I heard that, it was fascinating because it was like ebooks 5 years ago. I remember being at the fair and hearing the publishers saying, oh, well, you know, now we kind of have to go back to what we've published in the past and start making ebook versions of these print books. And that's why even now there's still books that are not available on ebook. So making more of what you have was a really big sort of theme. And I talked about this in my New Year's sort of goals for 2019 was to make more of what I have. And for me, that is putting books into audio, large print and hardback, as well as just ebook and paperback. And I don't expect to be able to give you any good stats on this for another year, at least, because all of these formats take time to grow. So, for example, we just looked before this at one of my series, the London Crime Thriller series or the London Psychic series. There's three books and they're all in large print, and the demand for large print mystery seems to be very strong. I mean, just from us, so we've sold, I think, something like 75 books in large print just with those three. Now, with ebook sales, that's not very much, right? But that's 75 large print books to a market who are not well served, and I'm just getting started. So, you know, and that's what, $150 or something. You know, it's just another thing. To me, that's another stream of income that I didn't have this time last year. And that's what I love about this business. You can just turn on another stream of income and it's very cool. Okay, what else? They mentioned the future of listening and talked about connected home, connected cars, self-driving in 3 to 5 years' time, and very much that the expected rise in listening will continue. I guess, you know, we had thought that people might move more to ebooks. That hasn't happened. But it's interesting that audiobooks, to me, are a different form entirely, because I can listen and read with my ears while I'm doing other things. So I can fit more books into my life by listening. So yeah, super fascinating stuff. Also, I met a lot of authors who did not know that, yes, of course, there is a 7-year exclusivity with ACX if you have gone with the royalty share option, which many authors have. I did in the early years. But if you have paid for your own production, it's only 1 year. And at the moment, I'm opting out of all my exclusive contracts once the year is up. So if you have paid up front, you can opt out and go non-exclusive. Yes, you are going to drop your royalties on ACX, but you can be wide. And a lot of people, a lot of the publishers were emphasizing that you are leaving money on the table if you are not on these other platforms. So yeah, really interesting discussion on audio. I also had a fascinating discussion with Giacomo from StreetLib about the next 5 billion people coming online in developing markets. And I've talked about this before, the 2025 goal of to get the internet to every person on earth by 2025. And 5 billion people who will be mobile first and need serving with content. Now, StreetLib have this wonderful plan, and they have now rolled out across Africa, and they're opening publishing portals for all the African countries. I love this, and I am going to get some nonfiction books onto their platform soon in order to see what other new markets I can reach. And of course, Kobo and Apple and, you know, lots of the other companies are in Africa, but Amazon isn't. So this is a very interesting time, I think, with the developing markets. And also, it just struck me when I was talking to Giacomo that we're so lucky. We are so lucky. If you're listening to me in a country where you have all the opportunities. I mean, even basically, if you're in America, you have all the opportunities. I mean, even here in the UK, which is generally second on the rollout plan, like I was saying, to Findaway Voices, the Findaway app, or even the new BookBub Chirp app, which is going to be for audiobook promotion. Oh, I didn't even mention that. You know, we're going to have audiobook promotion. And then I asked them and it's only available in America. So, but it's the rollout of these things. I just felt, wow, do you know, we take it for granted now that we can self-publish because I've been doing this for 10 years, but there are markets where this hasn't even started yet. So don't feel, I mean, sometimes I feel that how do people not know about indie? But actually, you know, I was talking to Mark Dawson about this, and we were saying maybe 1% penetration at the moment of the even in English speaking places. So this is, yeah, don't take being indie for granted. We have so much opportunity. It is as Jeff Bezos says, it is always day one. Okay, what else? Yes. Oh, and I wanted to mention for global publishing stories, make sure you follow the New Publishing Standard, which is at thenewpublishingstandard.com, which is sponsored by Streetlib. And they cover a lot of the expansion of indie and publishing outside the US and other mainstream markets. Oh, what else? See, you see, it was a big fair. I had so much I had to cull down what I share with you. What else? And I'll probably add some more stuff in as I go. I just don't have enough time to tell you everything. Oh, yes, there was a lot of talk about nonfiction being more popular this year. And it was so funny because they were spinning it as, oh, well, you know, nonfiction is having its rise. Things are starting to happen in the nonfiction space. And I think this comes back to what I said probably last October, September, October, when I came back from NINC and said, look, with this change in the algorithm, what we're going to see is traditional publishing will not put money into advertising smaller authors. So you're inevitably going to see dropping sales for traditionally published authors who are not getting big marketing spend, which means that they will, and nonfiction is much easier to sell because it has a clear value to the reader. It has, you know, often you can charge higher prices, you don't have to heavily discount. So I think what's happening is, it's not so much reader preference as ability to market nonfiction has become, well, not easier. That's stayed easy, but the ability to market fiction has become harder. So because it's not a easy search and find a book. So I wanted to kind of mention that, but, you know, certainly with audio is another example. Nonfiction audio is cheaper to produce because it's shorter and readers are less price sensitive. So we're seeing a really interesting time in the market. It's always an interesting time. what else? I did have a quick chat with a lady from Storytel who did mention the need for global rights content. So they, she was saying that sometimes it's a struggle because, you know, you might talk to a publisher in the UK and they only have UK Commonwealth rights, but a company like Storytel is rolling out into Latin America, for example. So if they don't have the rights for that content in Latin America, how do they make their catalogue available to everyone? Same with Findaway. If you have global rights and you've put your audio up there, or Streetlib or PublishDrive or Drafter Digital, you can basically get into global markets that traditional publishers are only just thinking about because we have global rights. So again, if you license some of your rights, if you are taking a publishing deal or you have a publishing deal, make sure it's territory specific. So the first question I ask, there was a couple of authors you asked me at the fair, so how can I get my rights back? And the first thing I do is I say, well, what rights have you licensed? And generally, most of those authors say they don't even know. They didn't even check their contract. So that's the first thing to do. Check your contracts. You might not have licensed things. It's very likely you're going to struggle now because I think publishers want world English. That was definitely what they were talking about. But yeah, definitely see if you can negotiate if you are going to take a deal for any format. So that was the book fair, but I also did a full day workshop on audiobook narration this last week at the Showreel in London. If you are in the UK, the Showreel is excellent, highly recommended. I learned an awful lot. And also, after quite an excruciating time in the professional booth with my fiction, I decided, because I've been doing my fiction at home, so I can take really long sentence breaks while I kind of change my character. And if you've listened to 1,000 Fiendish Angels, you'll know I made an attempt at other voices. But what I discovered and what I've decided this week is to be more of a storyteller type narrator like Neil Gaiman. If you've listened to Neil Gaiman narrate his books, he doesn't do voices. He doesn't do special voices. He doesn't try and act. He just tells you a story. And it was great to do this course with other people because I have done one-on-one training, but this was in a room with, what, seven other people who wanted to get into narration. And so I learned from them as well. And that I thought that was brilliant. And it was so clear with some of the people there who were actors that they would literally switch between sentence to sentence. They would switch their voice. And I don't want to learn that. That is acting training. I'm not doing that. So my narration will be more like, let me tell you a story type of thing. But what's so interesting is my husband, who listens to a lot of audio, and he had told me, oh, I really know you have to act. You have to have the different voices. But he loved Neil Gaiman, and he didn't even realize there was a difference in the way the narration was happening. He was so invested in the story. So whatever preconceptions you have about listening to audio, once you start listening to different audiobooks, you get to discover what might work for you. So I thought that was interesting. A couple of other interesting things. The director, who was fantastic, said that there is never enough punctuation in books. So when she directs even professional actors to narrate books, they struggle because the narrator has to respect the punctuation. But often the grammatical use of commas is not the same as the way a narrator needs to breathe. And generally the direction was breathe on the comma, which is how I think I was taught very young. But then what I find is editors, and what there was a couple of other authors in the room said, oh, editors, remove my commas, because the grammatical use of commas is not the same as the way you would want to use commas for narration. And what the director said is that if you're prepping a manuscript for narration, even if it's someone else's manuscript, you have to add in commas in order to help yourself breathe and still keep the sense of what's going on. So I think there is a need for specialist editors who work with authors to turn books into a better form for narration. So I think this is a growth opportunity for editors and people who specialize in audio. As I'm editing my own work for narration, and as I narrate my own books, I find I'm adding punctuation or removing it, changing words. I am going to write about this at some point, but it's fascinating stuff. You must know. You know by now. I love this stuff. Another interesting thing was a discussion of the economics of audiobooks from the perspective of the director and the producer, as well as the narrator. All of those people get paid by finished hour of audio. And if you've done any audio work, you know that the finished hour does not have necessarily a close reflection of how many hours it took you to actually prep it. And there's a lot of prep work for audio narration. I know myself from even short stories, but they showed us some examples of scripts prepped by professional narrators with, for example, the different characters highlighted in different colours, little notes on tone of voice and character. And so the prep work they don't get paid for that. They only get paid per finished hour. So editing doesn't count. You can see that it's very difficult. And they actually said no one makes any money out of audio except for Audible and the publishers, which means the rights holder makes the money in audio. And I thought that was fascinating, and I had to pipe up just because I can't keep my mouth shut at these things, and said, if you're an author who has kept your rights, you can make money from audio, because once you've invested in that initial creation, you get paid every month, and that is exciting. And there are more audio opportunities every month. So yeah, I couldn't help myself. And I was trying to talk about this intellectual property idea. And again, I was so struck at the fair because of course the publishers who are doing all the talks at the fair, they own the rights. And so fascinating. And I think I've just come away feeling very empowered and grateful for the choices I've made to be independent. And of course, you know, it's tough, especially at fairs, because you feel at some places you feel like a second-class citizen because you're independent or self-published. But then I'm sitting there feeling quite self-righteous because I just got a good whack of cash in my bank account from audio rights, for example. So just because I didn't get published by Audible, then that's not a big deal. So really interesting. And I urge you, if you still don't understand intellectual property rights and how to make long-term money from licensing rights, this is something you want to spend more time learning about. And I was very interested this week the focus on intellectual property was made very clear, because Disney, this deal's been going through for a while, but Disney now owns 21st Century Fox, X-Men, and most of Hulu. Now, that deal is all about original intellectual property, and now they are going to turn that into the Disney Netflix, whatever the Netflix of Disney is going to be. It's going to be fascinating, because that's a huge amount of IP that they are then going to turn into their own app. Apple is also has got some really big names like Steven Spielberg and Reese Witherspoon and people like that doing content just for them, exclusive content. So this IP stuff, this is just more and more important. So I hope you find that interesting, and that I've given you some ideas and some thoughts and things to look into. So my personal update, obviously, with it's really been a busy few weeks with the book fair, recovery, the audiobook day. I've also been writing a lot, so prep for my solo shows, like last week's solo show. That was about 6,000-7,000 words, and I write that stuff. I prepare that beforehand. And then I've also been doing the Books and Travel podcast. I've got 3 solo shows now out on that podcast. It's around 15,000 words I've written. The latest one is all about the myth and reality of Venice. I've been writing a lot. I've written maybe 20,000-25,000 words in the last couple of weeks that are not to do with Map of Plagues, my next novel. But you know what? It's fine, because I have a multitudinous body of creative work. And I also don't have a production schedule as such. I'm just leaning into what I am interested in and what I want to create in the world. I will get back to Map of Plagues. I know I will finish that novel. I just need to clear the decks of a few things. 2019 is turning out to be a transition year in many ways. And I'm thrilled with how Books and Travel is going. And I'm also quite shocked at what's happening to me by doing it, because I am seriously putting myself out there with that new podcast. And I've had lots of comments. I've made some people cry, which is making me tear up myself, and people saying that they're seeing a different side of me. And I don't know, I've been happy as Joanna Penn for so many years, and now I feel like Jo Frances Penn is finding her voice. So yeah, and it's taken a lot of years for me to be able to go into a lot of this. So yeah, it's definitely some transition stuff going on. But as I said, I'm sticking around here. I'm still Joanna Penn. I'm still doing the Creative Penn. But I'm really enjoying doing other things too. So useful stuff. Every year during the book fairs, the Alliance of Independent Authors does a free online conference, and you can go and listen and watch the sessions right now at selfpublishingadviceconference.com. This year, and there are some seriously good sessions, it includes author business models, how to get your books into bookstores. There's actually 2 sessions on that. Amazon ads, how to use Patreon, how to do multiple streams of income, how to outline your book, and also a session on how to write into the dark and not outline at all with Dean Wesley Smith. There's collaboration. There's how authors can use YouTube, how to publish wide, a couple of sessions on that too. Tips for literary fiction authors and those who write outside of genre, which is a great session if you feel like so much of this advice doesn't apply, and so much more. So definitely go check it out at selfpublishingadviceconference.com. So thanks for all your emails and tweets about the 10th anniversary show. It has been truly wonderful to hear how the podcast has helped people over the years. Some of you have been listening since almost the very beginning. And I did once set a goal to help 1 million books be born into the world, empower people to create 1 million books. And I've pretty much lost count by now, but you know, perhaps I'm getting up there. And I'm so pleased to know that I've helped a lot of you to write and publish and get your words into the world. So there were so many tweets and emails and comments that I can't share everything, but thanks to everyone who left them or emailed me or tweeted. I just appreciate it so much. Just a couple then. Frank said, another great episode. I love these solo big picture introspections that you do. Congratulations on a decade of podcasting. I rarely miss an episode. Thanks, Frank. Marion says, congrats congrats on 10 years of the podcast. I've been a listener since 2014, and Mary and I always enjoy your comments, and I've learned a lot about indie publishing. Also, I listened to all 4 episodes of Books and Travel podcast, enjoyed them all, and look forward to listening more about your travels. Some other comments. Christine says, a huge thanks for suggesting large print editions. Just sold one copy of my organising book yesterday and another today. And again, I think I'm sparking a large print revolution, which I just love. Chad Petit said, in the gym, being a healthy writer while listening to the podcast. Fantastic. And finally, Jamie Davis at PodMedic says, welcome to the 10-year podcaster club. I started my medical shows here in this kitchen after everyone went to bed back in 2005. So Jamie is rocking it. Love your show. Keep it up. Thanks, Jamie. Right, today's show is sponsored by Drafter Digital. And talking of publishing wide, the wonderful Drafter Digital, who I publish with, I'll play a word from the lovely Kevin Tomlinson, the dulcet tones of Kevin, coming in a minute. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by you on Patreon. So thanks to everyone supporting the show and new patrons, Chase Moore, Joan Robinson, Andrea Kamanka or Kamancha, Kerry Oman, Jess Mastorakis, Amy Lilly, Mahi, and also thanks to Cindy Sherman for increasing her pledge. I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. If you listened to last week's show, you know how much it means to me. And it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. So you can support the show with a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous. And you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I just put out for March, went out on the Patreon feed for patrons only. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Drafter Digital, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hi, this is Kevin Tomlinson with Drafter Digital, bringing you the D2D Smart Author Tip number 9. When it comes to finding advice and services and tools to help you build and grow your author business, you should be picky. Only take advice from someone who's done what you're trying to do, like certain British authors / podcasters, but also certain businesses that are built around your needs as an indie author. Draft to Digital was founded by an indie author, and several of our employees are either authors themselves or have worked in the industry for years. We know self-publishing because we are self-publishers just like you. Swing by and learn more about what we've built to help you, including our industry-leading blog full of useful information that can help you build and grow your author career. Start reaching a bigger audience now. Convert your manuscript, distribute it online, and get support the whole way at drafttodigital.com/pen. Sign up now and get a free author marketing guide, drafttodigital.com/pen. Happy writing.
Today, I'm here with Damon Swade. Hi, Damon.
Hi, Joanne. So good to be here. I have been waiting for this like you wouldn't believe.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Just a little introduction. Damon has worked as a performer, director, and writer in film and theatre. He now writes award-winning gay romance and erotica and teaches writers how to use their words more effectively for writing and marketing. And today we're talking about his book, Verbalize, Bring Stories to Life and Life to Stories. And I heard you talk about this at NINC last year. So I've been waiting, 6 months since I heard you speak?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I've been following the Creative Pen for so long. I'm such a huge fan. And when I found, but they invited me to come and I was like, well, who are the speakers? And you know that you do that thing where you think, should I? And I was like, oh my gosh, she's coming from Bath. I'm so excited. I'm a Jane Austen fan. So I would come there to visit you, but it was nice for you to come here.
Oh no, it's fantastic. Right. So tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing, because your background is pretty varied, I guess.
The short version, and I'm a talker, but the short version is I was a song and dance kid. I had a freak singing voice when I was a little boy. I had a four and a half octave range. And having done a lot of musicals, I got hired to do a production of Midsummer Night's Dream while I was living in London. And while I was living in New York, I moved to London, did a bunch of Shakespeare. And while there, I got hired to write a play. And I started writing plays pretty much full time. I actually tried to emigrate to the UK, which you UKers know that can be quite difficult. And then when I wound up giving that up because I didn't want to pay double taxes, I moved back to the States and I worked in theater. And then Robert De Niro bought a play of mine for film. And then that led to a lot of film writing, both live action and animated, because I have sort of a knack for physical comedy and like badinage. And so I had been doing that for about 20 years, 19 years. And a friend of mine dared me to write a romance. She was working on a story. She was stuck. My husband's a forensic investigator. You met him in
Florida. And he's coming on the show.
I know. I'm so excited. He's very excited. He's actually on a case right now. But anyway, so she dared me to write a romance, which is the worst thing you can do to me because I am a person who responds to that kind of provocation. So I wrote my first romance in 6 weeks. I sold it in 2 days and then it was number one for 6 months. And it made so much money and I met all these amazing fans in the romance industry. And I called my agent and I said, I never want to work for the Weinstein brothers again. By the way, good choice. And when I sort of learned how loving and supportive and cool and funky and experimental romance could be, I just fell into it. And so I really came from this weird background as like a singer, dancer, circus freak. And I wound up writing love stories. The irony is I grew up about 10 blocks from where RWA was founded, Romance Writers of America. I also weirdly read romance. I just never thought I would write it. But now I can't imagine doing anything else.
Oh, it's so cool. It's such an interesting origin story because a lot of people, I think, who start as writers want to end up writing in film.
Right. And it's a question I get. People will say like, golly gee willikers, I'd like to have a movie made of my book. And I'm like, wrong answer. You think you want a movie made of your book. What you want is like Tom Hiddleston to come massage your feet or Kate Blanchett to mop your brow with Idris Elba fanning you. But that's actually not what writing is in the movies. In film, a screenwriter is the lowest critter on the totem pole. So they treat you like garbage, but they pay you well. It's a very odd industry.
Yeah. We're going to come back to the romance side, but let's get into Verbalize because when I came to your session, and I would say to anyone listening, if Damon is speaking, definitely go to the session. I was really surprised, I think, because I wasn't really expecting. I don't know what I expected of you, but I think maybe it's your Shakespearean side. But this is a love letter to words and grammar. So we've mentioned 100%. The G word. We are mentioning the G word and your book is full of grammar. And it's so interesting. I even today I've been spending time with my thesaurus and I just love it. So can you talk about some of the most common weaknesses that you see in books based on writing itself?
It's funny. I think the number one problem we have as a culture is generality. I think that we forget that the phrase mass market, mass hyphen market, literally means generic content produced in a factory for the lowest common denominator. And I think it's very easy to sort of absorb jokes and tropes and things that are sort of streamlined for maximum absorption. And it's great if you want to write oatmeal or like frozen Salisbury steak. But if you want to write something that is spicy or strange or provocative or interesting or imaginative or weird, it's very difficult to shake off the bland beige cubicle culture that we're sort of raised to populate. And so what I always say to baby writers, the first thing I say is kill your generality, kill your cliches, avoid them like plague and death and syphilis sores, because it's so easy to kind of fall into language that's weak. The average sitcom has a vocabulary of 450 words. The average Shakespeare play has a vocabulary of 5,100 words. So why would you feed yourself pap and expect to sort of produce steaks? And so I'm always saying to people, like, read widely, look further, dig deeper, because each of us has stories that need telling and each of us has a voice that is distinct. But because we watch this uniform entertainment, we get in the habit of using bland language. And so I'm always saying, it doesn't have to be like, I'm a very wacky speaker. It doesn't have to be wacky. It just has to be specific to you, to your individuality, your authentic self.
Mm. And you talk about the story's verbal palette, which I really love as a phrase. So how can we build that up for our work?
Well, I think it's funny. I did my thesis on anti-humanist pornography during the French Enlightenment. In this conversation I was having about pornography in the 18th century, I realized in the 18th century there was this belief that the clock face was the world, when actually the greasy gears under the clock face is the real world. And so I think as a writer, it's very easy to get seduced by the effect we produce on the reader rather than thinking about the cause that underlies it. I had a student, I was just down in Florida last month, and a student said to me, she had gone through Verbalize, she had taken a full day workshop with me, and then she had read the book, and she came up to me and she said, I feel like Neo in the Matrix, as if I'd looked through the words, I'd looked through the character. And it's not that the character doesn't have all that extraneous stuff. It's that the core of energy in the character is tappable. And the other thing I always say is, like, when I first taught Verbalize, everyone said, oh, this is so wacky, it's so weird what you're doing. And I said, actually, I think everyone does this. I think that we've been taught to think of stories as dollhouses. When we have these little dolls and we march them around and we make them do things, mm-hmm. when actually, if you let stories verbalize themselves, the words will make the most emotional impact. So you have to sort of push your margins. You have to, again, this is sort of back to the weaknesses in writing. I think the great strength of genre fiction as an industry, as a career, is that it tests your limits, the limits of your curiosity, the limits of your emotion, the limits of your openness, right? Your willingness to live other lives. There's a great book by Keith Oatley called Such Stuff as Dreams. And he says that fiction allows us to experience danger at a safe emotional distance. And so I think about that sometimes, like, how can I put my readers in emotional danger at a safe distance? And I think that by pushing language, we make people look at things in an unexpected way. And so that verbal palette becomes something that we lay out that lets them play with us. It lets them kind of get down in the mud with us. Mm. A character is an action figure, right? It has a range of motion. It's not a person, but that range of motion is limited by what they must do in the story. And so giving them fun things to play with is our job, right? Mm. And so the better we get at our job, the more fun the readers have, the more readers we have, the more we get paid, we don't starve to death and live on Drano under a bridge. I mean, these are all good things.
Yeah.
These are all
good things. So just be a bit more specific about the verbal palette, or, you know, give us an example.
An example. Yeah. Okay. So for example, one of the things people, like when I was writing film, I would get hired to adapt a novel, and the director would say to me, this is really written as a light, quirky comedy, but we're going to film it as a rom-com. Now, like, light sitcom and rom-com have different actions for the actors. There are different things you're going to ask your actors to do. Well, the same thing is true in a novel. If I'm writing a novel and I want it to be sort of a quirky comedy of manners, that's very different from a farce or from a situation comedy or from a romantic comedy. And by looking at the kinds of language that I use on the page, I'm cueing the readers at all times so that they know, oh, this is the world I'm in. Oh, this is the limits. This is the absolute high, the absolute low. Because when I go into a book called Spot the Bunny, I don't expect it to be about, like, late stage capitalism. Or if I go into a techno thriller, I don't think it's going to be recipes for muffins. And I think that we forget as writers that we're constantly giving our readers cues and clues. And that also feeds into characterization, because you want to produce a character that pushes the edge of what is expected, but also exceeds those expectations in a fascinating way. And so by using certain kinds of language, if I say Pride and Prejudice has action-wise for characters things like provoke, preserve, taunt, pester, tease. The actions of the characters are framed by the milieu of early 19th century suburb. I shouldn't suburb. There was no suburb there. Rural England, right? Middle bourgeois England of the 19th century. But if I update Pride and Prejudice and I'm setting it now in the 20th century, I have a good friend, Sonali Dave, who just did an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. And her language for that book is very different. It has things like smolder, tempt, arouse, that you would never have used in the world. It's a different palette. And so in the same way that if I'm making curry or if I'm making pizza or if I'm making tom kha gai, the mise en place, like the ingredients I lay on the counter are going to be different. And I'm going to prepare them differently and my tools are different. And so I think as an author, taking hold of that process, right? Like real, again, like the Matrix, looking through the surface at the energy kind of pulsing in the story gives you both a faster process because you're not getting bogged down in extraneous detail, but also a more productive process because you're actually kind of hitting the sweet spot when you need to.
And I think it's so interesting. I just want to be clear for everyone. You're not saying use massive, long words. You're not saying more literary words in your genre fiction, are you? That's not what you mean.
No, it's really more using clearer words because truthfully, you know, they always say when you start writing, you should use good Anglo-Saxon monosyllables, right? Mm. You want things like give, take, make, clear, break, seduce, honor, like very clear language because everyone understands them. It's the reason that politicians are always using sort of fourth and fifth grade language because the most number of people can understand them. But let me tell you, there are simple words. Like I could say the word inveigle, right, which has certain connotations. But if I say seduce or convince, they actually mean a very similar thing, but they're clearer for the reader. And so depending on the kind of world I'm building, it changes the shape of their experience, right? It invites them in a different way. So no, it doesn't have to be $10 words. I love a good, strong Anglo-Saxon. I love a good Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. But one of the brilliant things about English is we have about 5 times the vocabulary of every other language. And so, you know, it's like, you know, 50 words for snow, right? That we have so many words for love, so many words for fight, so many words for forgive, so many words for sacrifice. And by using that texture, you build out a verbal palette, a sort of a language scape that the reader can dive into. And sometimes they don't even realize it. It's not like the reader's not there like going through their dictionary learning things. It's that without realizing it, they sort of absorb the little gems that you bury there. So it's like there's a thing in New Orleans, at Mardi Gras, they bake what's called a king cake and they've stud it with these little toys. They're called faves, and there's like a baby and a crown and a key. And depending on what slice of cake you get, you have a different fortune for the year. I always say that writing is like baking a king cake. You're just burying little treasures. And if they want to go looking, it's there. But you don't want to exclude the people who don't feel like looking. Maybe they're just like tired in the hospital watching their father get over a broken leg and they just want to be entertained. But the richness underneath is what brings them back. It's what allows your voice to sort of emerge authentically.
Mm. I've got a couple of things in that. So first of all, I think coming back to genre fiction, which we both write, and I think one of the criticisms of genre fiction is often, and you mentioned the house actually, like a structure, often we focus maybe more on structure than on words, which are traditionally associated more with literary writers poets. So how, you know, what do you think about that? Is that a fair criticism of genre writing or just unthinking genre writing?
I think it's really more, this sounds terrible. I think it's really the difference between good writers and crappy writers. I mean, I feel like hack work in literary fiction is no less hacky than hack work in junky tentacle porn on Amazon. There's literary fiction, like post-structuralist literary fiction on Amazon makes me want to eat a razor. But by pushing yourself, by expanding the words you feel comfortable using, by getting sort of, I don't think you have to dig into anything fancy. You could use a fourth grade dictionary, but by expanding your dexterity, your verbal dexterity, it allows you to paint with a different brush when it's needed. And so in a way, what you're doing is constantly testing the margins of what's possible. I always encourage writers, the nice thing about working this way, about working with this technique that I use for characterization and dramatization, is that you cannot plagiarize verbs. They're words. Mm. So it's just a word. So I can be at a story weekend with you and we can plan books next to each other using the exact same words and write completely different books because your voice and my voice are different. And so I encourage people, like, go out and read more, explore more, like get to know other authors in your genre and not just the safe ones. explore the crazy ones, explore the ones that mess up, look backwards, look at the history of your genre and find the things, the sort of treasure buried, because I do think we get into this habit, especially post Amazon, into this belief that the new book is the best book, right? That the one book that you have to pay attention to is the one from 3 months ago, not 30 years ago. And there's a lot of great literature out there. And I don't mean literary fiction. I mean great pulp fiction, great genre fiction that can enrich our voices and our craft and build us outward, you know?
Mm, yeah, I mean, like in the horror genre, H.P. Lovecraft would be
oh, my God, yes. I'm a huge
fan. I mean, he made up words all the time.
Actually, Tolkien. It's so funny. I was just teaching a class on Tolkien to a group of fantasy people, and Tolkien invents a word almost every three pages. Like, he just invents words. And or if you look at William Gibson, Neuromancer, I'm a genre slut. Like, I read everything. I will read any genre. And one of the things you notice about the defining authors of a genre is how bold they are. They're so specific and they're so bold with their language because it's their one power. It's not that they have like a cool typeface on their book cover, right? It's that the language, the verbalization is so powerful. When do your kids come to you and say, "Mom, what color is Cinderella's hair? Like, tell me the story about the guy with the limp." What they say is, "Tell me what happened. What happened? What was the action of the story? What moved me in the story?" Because what they want is an emotional ride. And that's our job, right? Emotional rides. And so by studying emotional rides, by looking at sort of the things around our emotional experience, we learn to verbalize things. And it's, again, that matrix thing. I think that when you start to think of story this way, you start to look past surfaces. And that doesn't mean everything has to be sort of mulabandha chakra and squatting over a mirror. I think that you can actually look through any story, through a video game, through a porn comic. Every story has actions. And when you look at the energy in the story, you learn what affects people. And it's like being a carpenter. Carpenters learn to use wood and grain and tools to get the wood and grain to do what they want. And so as an author, I always say when I'm teaching in class, how many grammar nerds do we have? And there's always a show of hands. And then I say, how many people hate grammar? And they're always like a sort of embarrassed smattering. And then my answer every time is, when you were a kid, you hated grammar because it was boring. But now grammar is a magic tool that pays you money and makes your life bigger and better and draws in fans and gives you better orgasms. Like, everything about grammar is good now, because now it's your magic wand. You can do anything with it. But I think we get in our heads, because when you're a kid, like, who wants to learn the subjunctive, right? Who cares what a transitive verb is? But when you actually are writing, that's a superpower. And if I said to you, look, you can control the weather, but only if you study, would you sit on your ass with a towel over your head? No, you would want to say, like, yes, tornadoes, yes, lightning. You want the superpowers. And so I always say, like, embrace the things that will give your voice more power, more energy, right? Mm.
Yeah. And in talking about voice, because I think this is why I'm so into this now. I mean, when I heard you speak, I got into it, but I've got much more into it as I'm now narrating my own fiction. Because what's happened is I'm reading. And although when you edit your own work, or you use a professional editor even, you figure out repeated words, but repeated sounds in audio is fascinating to me. And I've discovered so many things where I'm like, so repeated sounds, but also the word said, because one of the things that we're told is just use the word said for dialogue. But actually, that's completely wrong when you're writing for audio. I wondered comment on those.
Well, when I was a child, because I had this weird voice, I did a lot of voiceover as a child. And so when I went into theater, you know, you rehearse out loud with another human being. You're always acting. You're taking action with actors who act. So you're always doing something. And so no actor is going to sit there and say, like, but what adjective should I be thinking about? What they want to know is, what am I doing? What is important? What matters, right? So when you're writing, like, I read my writing out constantly. I dictate now. I went through a phase where I was skeptical of dictation because I speak so quickly. Mm. And a friend of mine down in DC said, no, try the new Dragon. It's great. And I love it. It has, because A, it's doubled my production time in terms of just word count. Mm. But also, I read my work out always, because I was a voiceover guy and because I know the books are going into audio. So part of my editorial process is I literally read it to the wall. I just read it out loud. And so now that I'm dictating, I've eliminated that step, because I'm always reading out loud. I'm always thinking about the sounds. I'm always thinking about the shape of the vowels and consonants on the page and how they establish, again, how they establish energy. I mean, think about it. Darcy is not a man. Darcy is a series of black squiggles on a piece of paper a couple centuries ago. And yet we have very strong feelings about Fitzwilliam Darcy and all of his decisions. That's not because of the squiggles, right? Mm. That's because of the way the words went together. And I think that reading out loud teaches you to look differently at how words go together. It goes back to that childhood habits thing. You were taught as a kid, write three sentences or punctuate your dialogue. But when you're a writer, you're trying to go deeper. You're trying to sort of dig in further to the experience of your audience. Mm. And so you have to kind of unlearn these lazy, like, grind out another page, grind out another thing. She's pretty because she's the heroine. All these cliches that we pick up as children, right? That we pick up as students.
Mm. I find this endlessly fascinating, but I want to come back on characters because you say characters are action figures. You said that a while ago. In the book, you say characters are not people. They're purpose-built narrative tools to extract satisfying emotion from your audience. And I know some people are like, what? But it's like you said about Cinderella's hair. I'm with you on this. I don't do character bios. I just write like people emerge because they're doing something in my book. They are acting. Right. So explain more about characters not being people.
So it's funny. I do character bios, but I don't start with them. Mm. I think that so if I may, I'm going to tell a little bit of a story. Mm. Popular fiction came of age at the rise of the mass, like of the printing press and mass culture and the rise of cities in the late 19th century. At the same time, a new science called psychology was being invented by Germans who sat around thinking for a long time, possibly because they were constipated and had a lot of time sitting around. And so in thinking about things and thinking about psychology, they set up certain theories about the ways that minds operated and emotions operated. Because of that, it was trendy at a time when people were first trying to figure out how to write fiction. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things sort of established by early psychology were enshrined in the writing process without anyone ever looking at it. And so I collect writing guides. I love writing guides. So I have writing guides from the 18th, 19th century. I read in French, German. I find it fascinating how people put a story together and how they tell people to. Most people who write writing guides are not writers. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're doing what Aristotle did. They're looking at something after the fact and they're like, huh, I see the object. I'm going to take the object apart. Aristotle was a biologist. He dissected things. Mm-hmm. And so if you go into a book and you dissect it, well, that's great. I now know what a dead fetal pig looks like when I cut it apart. But I can't produce a fetal pig. I can't make a fetal pig oink or walk around or be cute or anything else. And so it's weird to me that writers are like, wow, I can dissect this thing and that will make me able to make the thing. In 1933, a scholar named Elsie Knights wrote this article called How Many Children Had Lady Macbeth? And he was making fun of all these critics that were like, if Lady Macbeth was a color, what color would she be? If Lady Macbeth was able to sort of strike out her own, would she get a divorce? And his point was, Lady Macbeth doesn't have any children. That's not the story. In fact, Lady Macbeth, in a play that has over 2,000 lines, Lady Macbeth has 252 lines and she doesn't have a name. She literally is one of the most famous women in history, in literary history. We know her epically. Everyone can think of that out, out, down, spot gesture. But they don't know her name. Incidentally, her name was Gruach. She was really cool, but different conversation. The point is that if you're Shakespeare, you don't give a damn how many kids she had. You're telling a story. Your actors need to do something. All of that blather is a way for academics to write articles and get published so they can get tenure. Here's the problem. Because of the rise of mass publishing, because people wanted to be writers, they read these critics and they were like, oh, I have to produce a three-dimensional character. I need to do an entire breakdown of everything. I need to know how many ingrown hairs she had on her first date. I need to know where he parts his hair. And listen, I love character detail. I love all that stuff at the end. But if you start from Lady Macbeth had red hair, what if you're wrong? Hmm. What if that trivial nonsense gets you into the weeds, if it leads you into mud? The problem is that starting with trivia produces trivial stories. And we've been taught, because for 80, 90 years, we've been hearing, no, no, three-dimensional characters, yes, yes, psychology. The truth is, characters have something very like psychology. They have cause and effect. They do things because of things, and because they do things, other things happen, right? That's causality. But a character cannot have psychology because a character does not have a life. They are not people. They do not have childhood. She did not have a mother. She is 252 lines handwritten on parchment. So the idea that we're going to extrapolate like how she felt about kleptocracy or what she would wear to her wedding is pointless. It's useful as an exercise academically, but if you're a writer on deadline, why would you waste all that time? And I'm going to ask you, I'm asking you, creative pen readers, when you fill out those bios that say, how tall is she? What color is her hair? What color are her eyes? What kind of job does she have? What is she wearing on her first date? What sound does she make when she screams? Like all those things. How much of it do you really use? Mm. I predict that you use about 2%. And that means 98% of the stuff you are creating in these, I call them impersonal ads, is you're creating data that is completely wasted. The equivalent is making an omelet by smashing 200 eggs and aiming a flamethrower at the floor. It's the most inefficient, illogical way to work, when the truth is what people want to know is what the character does. They want to know what the action of the character is. And so why wouldn't you look at the core? And then once you know the action, you can decide what her job is, decide what her hair color is, decide what her name is based on who she is. How many of you would get married based on a personal ad? How many of you would hire someone strictly from a resume without meeting the person? Mm. Traits, characteristics are not character. And so for me, it's so obvious. It's funny. The first time I taught a class on verbalization, I thought everyone did this. Now, secretly, I think everyone does do this, but they pretend that they don't. Mm. What they're doing is they're extrapolating, right? They look at a picture of Tom Hardy and they're like, he's hot. Extrapolating from that, what would a hot guy wear? What would a hot guy do? So they're sort of doing it backwards. But the problem is it's such a waste of time. Instead, why not figure out who the character is and then go find a picture that looks like the energy of the character, right? Crack them open like a nut. And so if you're an author that loves bios, or you're an author that wants to do an astrological chart or an MBTI, great, that's fantastic. Do it when it's going to make a difference. Don't do it at the beginning and then just stick it on a shelf. It's like climbing a mountain with your lips. Why would you waste all that effort? It doesn't make any sense.
Mm. Yeah, and I know some people will find that contentious, but
I get crazy emails, believe me.
But I think it's very hard to encapsulate your book, which is massive and excellent and deep, this interview. So if people, you know, want to know more and about this character's act, it, you know, actually do something. That is the big point. The verbs, we haven't gone too much into grammar, really.
Well, I can do it in like a couple sentences. Mm. So imagine for those of you who have never taken a class with me or have never read my book, books about this. I believe that all characters are their actions. They are literally the verbs in a story. And so if I'm writing a character, I don't start with their hair color or their weight or their job or their function in the story or the kind of house they live in. I literally start from the thing that they do habitually. That's actually from Aristotle. The word Aristotle uses for character is ethos. It means habitual action. It's not a role. It's not a function. It is literally that which one habitually does. And so when you want to come up with a character, what do they do? That is always a transitive verb, a verb that can be done to or with something else. And so, for example, Severus Snape is not a teacher. He's not a martyr. He's not a hero. He's not an asshole. Those are all nouns. They don't tell me anything. He's not mean. He's not dark. He's not scary. He's not pitiful. Those are all adjectives, and they rely on assumptions. The only part of speech that always shows rather than telling is verbs. What Snape does in every scene of every one of those seven books is vex. He vexes everyone. He vexes Harry. He vexes his family. He vexes Lily. He vexes Voldemort. He vexes Dumbledore. He vexes everyone. He's always vexing. And then there's some of you that are going to say, yeah, 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 I get it. But he's so much more complicated. I agree. But I can prove it to you. The word Snape literally means vex. Literally, his name means I vex you severely. Ironically, when you start digging into characters the way, you notice that actually authors often will tell you without meaning to what the character is. There's this great line in Silence of the Lambs where they're talking about the serial killer, and Hannibal Lecter says, what does he do? And she says, well, he hunts. He hunts women. He skins women. And he says, no, first principles. What does he do? He covets. That is his action. Jane Gumm covets in that book. And every scene he's in, he's coveting. Now, some skeptics will come back and say, well, you can't do one thing for a whole book. I agree. Because although you have an action, for your entire existence as a person on the page, right? As a character, you have tactics, you have reactions, which are synonyms of that action. And so what happens over the course of a book is in every scene, I'll have a synonymous tactic that reflects their action. And what's cool for that is the reader never knows. They don't need to know. No one goes to an amusement park to look at the blueprints for a roller coaster. They want the ride. Your job is to give them the roller coaster. And so what those tactics do is build an emotional ride that also reveals facets around the character that reveal the scope of the character. But by keeping it active, you always know what the character does. You always know what's important to them. You always know what their goal is. And so every scene verbalizes itself because you know what their action and tactic is. And so stories sort of tell themselves. Do you know what I mean? I know that sounds very highfalutin, but it's true.
No, I totally agree. And actually, it's funny on the naming. When I look for a character name, I often, you know, Google Arabic for strong or, you know, Old English for something.
This is my thing. I believe that all authors do this intrinsically. I think this is like the Matrix. I think you look through all the fuzz and you find the thing that the character does all the time, because instinctively you don't want to watch a character that's sits around eating oatmeal. You want them to do something, right? Like your reader wants to feel something. And so instinctively, I think that people are doing this. I just don't think they're doing it consciously. And so I'm saying, like, if you're conscious about it, you'll be more efficient. You'll write better books. Here's a twofer. If you write this way, if you verbalize your stories, you actually know how to sell your stories, because what your characters do is how you sell them. Active transitive verbs are how you write marketing copy. Go and read marketing copy books. Go and read funnel marketing books. What they'll tell you is active, actionable transitive verbs, because they're call to action. That's what it is. You're asking people to participate in the emotional ride.
Well, we haven't got that much time left, and I want to just change tack a little bit.
No, please.
Because you're on the board of Romance Writers America, and you're heavily embedded in the romance community in the US, and in fact, all over the world. You travel over the world speaking. And romance is, I mean, you mentioned, I love at the beginning, you said it's a loving, supportive community, and, you know, but from the outside, let's face it, as we're talking, there's a lot of stuff going on. As we speak, the plagiarism stuff is, Nora Roberts even is blogging about this. And there's scammers in KU. Romance, because it's the highest earning genre, also attracts the most scammers because there's money there. So given your overarching view of the community and the genre, what are your thoughts on the best way for romance writers, people who really love the genre and want to do this for their career? How do they publish and market in an environment that seems quite difficult right now?
I think the danger, something wonderful and terrible, it was a sword that cut both ways. When EPUB, IndiePub, SelfPub exploded, suddenly the walls were down. And the Greeks were rolling into Troy, and anyone could be anything, right? Wild West. The trouble is, if you're a writer who loves to write stories, who loves the work and loves the industry and wants to give the fans things they never imagined for themselves, then you're always going to push to get better as a writer. You're always going to look for something that is more connected to who you are as an artist, as a business person. I think that what the scammers are doing, it's like the little red hen, right? The story of the little red hen. She bakes the bread, but everyone else wants to eat it. They're hobos. They ride the train that other people build and maintain. And so the way that hobos operate is by attaching themselves like lampreys or barnacles to a productive system. And so as an author, I think if you want to avoid that, if you want to escape that and keep the system healthy, you have to constantly be thinking first, how can I maintain the system in place? And then secondarily, if you're particularly strong or imaginative or legally minded, how can I build the system so I can protect my fellow authors? I think that romance has a unique opportunity. Romance is the most popular industry, and it is this giant money machine in some ways. But I always tell my readers this all the time. Romance is the literature of hope. I think the reason that romance gets such a bad rap is A, it's a genre by for with women, and women are treated like garbage in 90% of the cultures on our planet. And then simultaneously, hope is always looked at askance. And so I think as an author, if you want to carve out a path for yourself, you have to sort of have the courage of your own hope. You have to be willing to live not just profitably or successfully, but sort of hopefully. Mm-hmm. I did an interview recently for CNN, and someone said to me, what is the difference between writing romance and writing other genres? And I said, well, most genres, there's a very famous quote from Martin Luther King. He says, the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. Mm-hmm. I think that the moral arc of the universe bends towards grace. I don't think all of us want what we deserve. I think we want more, because if we all got what we deserve, I think we would all be pretty bummed. And I think that what romance does that's so amazing is it always gives you extra. It always gives you something more. And so I think if you're an author that wants to survive, thrive, boost the signal above the noise, you're going to be developing your voice. You're going to be pushing what is possible for you as an artist. You're not going to write to trends. You're going to set the trends. You're going to look backwards at the people who came before you and honor them and celebrate them. You're going to celebrate what's strong in the genre, because we all make more money when we all make more money. We all make more readers when we all make more readers. Every bestseller in human history has been created by non-readers, right? Vampire Lestat, Peyton Place, Gone with the Wind, a bunch of people who had never picked up a bunch of pages bound together as a book said, yeah, I'll check that out. That's how 50 Shades happened, right? Twilight, a bunch of people who weren't readers decided to become readers. And so if you want to beat scammers, become a bestseller. And I don't mean that in sort of like, become a bestseller and send me 1995. I mean, become a person who literally shapes pop culture, because we have that power. I think that especially in romance, we shape modern trends in a way that other genres can't, but we don't get credit because so much of it is done by women, and women often don't get credit for things that they do. And so as a person, if you were trying to fight scammers, think to yourself, is this the best book I can write? Am I pursuing what is possible in the future in my genre, not just following trends? Every scammer who has ever made a buck off Amazon followed rather than led. So lead, get out in front and lead. Mm-hmm. One of the things I loved about what happened as a result of hashtag copy paste Chris, who's Chris Saruya, this plagiarist down in Brazil, is that the entire romance community suddenly said, hey, wait a second. I think there's a problem in our industry. I think that actually people are not just taking advantage of us as people or as customers or as readers. They're taking advantage of us as artists, as human beings, as human souls. And so as a group, as a community, they said, what can we do to fix it as a community? Romance is predicated on the idea that relationships are more powerful than solitude. And so if you're writing romance, where's your community? Find your community. And if you don't believe in RWA or you don't like conferences or you find the people who think about books the way you do, who tell the kind of stories you want to tell, and work together, because we are always stronger as a team. And by celebrating great writing, by helping great stories, by boosting books that need a lift from communities that are marginalized or from people who might not get the same advantages that you do, we actually not only build the entire genre, but we build our own careers, right? Because those people are equally willing to help us when the time comes. Mm-hmm. It's a net, right? That sounds very like pie in the sky. But
yeah, no, but also I think big thanks to the romance community, because they're always out in front. It's a bit because they have been rejected in a way from the mainstream literary culture. Ebooks really started in romance, online marketing.
Every media has begun in romance. I mean, film started in romance, television started in romance, books started in romance. Every media that has ever existed in human culture, bas-reliefs began in romance. Vase paintings began in romance. Every media starts in romance. And it's ironic because it all starts there. And so everyone's like, oh, that old thing. Mm. Oh, that tacky old trope. And I want to say, this is like the Ur novel. There's a reason that the word roman means novel in so many languages. Mm. It's because we're the beginning of it. And that's not a position of sort of arrogance. That's just a position of reality. That's what it does. But I do think that romance also wants to help other genres, because so many romance writers write mystery, write thrillers, write sci-fi, write fantasy, write horror. They are in those other genres, because we experiment a lot. We take weird risks. I mean, for Christ's sake, there was a bestseller about spanking in red rooms. Anything is possible, right? But you have to sort of be willing to step outside of the shadow of your own steeple. You have to sort of say, I'm not just going to read in this little niche. I'm not just going to publish in this little niche. I'm not just going to talk to these four people. I'm going to educate myself. I'm going to join writers' organizations. I'm going to support the people who maybe don't always get the same break. I'm going to push further, look like dream harder, write bigger, because by doing that, we actually help not just genre fiction, but the world, right? We help people. I mean, I was on an interview once and someone said, don't you feel terrible teaching all these women to ask for things they'll never have? And I was really annoyed. I was pissed and I was going to bring it, right? And I put on my happy hat and I said, I don't teach people to ask for what they don't deserve. I teach people to ask for what they know they deserve, to push beyond the limits set on them by other people. Everyone deserves a happy ending. Everyone deserves hope. There is no person on this earth that does not deserve hope, even Donald Trump. There is no person that doesn't deserve a hand to help them into the light. And if you can help someone stand in the light, you are making the world better. And I think that sounds like a pretty good thing to do in your life, let alone in your career, right?
Oh, yeah. Let's make the world better. I think that's a good place to almost end, because I want to ask you about your new book, Activate, which as this interview goes out, will be coming either out now or out soon. So tell us what we can expect in Activate.
So when Verbalize came out, actually, when I started teaching these classes and I first wrote Verbalize, everyone was saying, I don't sort of work with verbs the way you do. I don't know as many verbs as you do. And there are not resources don't exist, which for purely transitive verbs that are useful for genre fiction. There are some light resources available for actors, but they're specific to actors and to performance on stage or on film. And so they kept saying, you have to write a thesaurus, you have to write a thesaurus. And so what I wrote was a giant, it started out as an appendix to Verbalize as 15,000 words. It's now 266,000 words. Mm-hmm. And it is sorted in three sections it's alphabetically, by genre, and then by direction. And the idea is, it is only active transitive language for genre fiction authors. And so right now it's actually in layout. Because it's a reference book, I want to make sure that it's super useful. Mm-hmm. Some people prefer it digital, some people prefer it physical. But yes, so that's coming out. Activate will be out in 30 seconds. I actually had a thing that happened I want to share, if it's okay. Last weekend in Florida, a television producer had come to me and said, oh, I just read Verbalize. This is so great. Have you considered doing some kind of a TED Talk? And I said, I'm happy to do a TED Talk. And she said, well, I actually started using it for myself. She said, well, isn't Damon Swade a public character? I said, absolutely. And she said, what's your action? And I said, oh, I can tell you immediately. I said, my action is energize. All I do is energize. She said, well, what about your tactics? I said, provoke, inspire, stimulate, shock, astonish, pester, all the things that I do, right? And so now it's actually become a way that I market myself as an author. I think, will this venue allow me to energize people? Will this podcast allow me to energize people? And I think as authors, we forget that we can write the future for ourselves, that we can take control of the narrative of our own careers. And so one of the things that's exciting about Activate is, when I was talking about this in Florida, this woman was like, I can't wait to find out what I'm going to do, because it's all these verbs that are just designed to make stuff happen, right?
I love that. And of course, Energize sounds like the title for another book.
Amen, sister. Amen.
Which I think would be awesome, because you definitely energize. You are a very energizing person.
It's how I am. It is my nature.
It is. So tell us where people can find you and your books online.
I am always at www.damonswade.com. My name is spelled DAMONSUEDE.com. I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, Goodreads. I'm sort of available everywhere writing gets wrestled or where romantic shenanigans take place. So I'm pretty much like mold. I'm everywhere. Lysol doesn't get rid of me.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Damon. That was great.
Oh, thank you so much, Joanna. It was really wonderful to spend time with you.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Damon today and that you will settle on your own verb. I decided that I am a create, not a write, because I actually love the creation side more than the writing. I hope you also learned a few things from the intro and my thoughts on London Book Fair and my audiobook day. So next week, I'm interviewing Jeff Simon on autopsies for authors, which is a super fascinating interview. And I love Jeff. He's awesome. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.